This is The Big Web Show, a live talk show about the web and the future of web publishing, hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman and Dan Benjamin. That's me. This episode is sponsored by the .tv domain name. That's right. The .tv domain name is the preferred destination for video content. With your own .tv domain, you can amplify and extend your own video conversation and let the world know you mean business about video. Go check them out. Get your own .tv domain name at getseenon.tv/bigweb. And we're also sponsored today by MailChimp, powerful email marketing. Build and manage your email lists, design killer HTML campaigns, and send emails with confidence. Free account has just been increased big time. You can store up to 1,000 subscribers and send 6,000 emails a month. And their new location-based technology gives you the power to send email campaigns that include geo-targeting, locally timed delivery, and more. Check them out at MailChimp.com/5x5 for special deals just for you guys. And here we are, Jeffrey. You had the idea that we would do this. You've got a little guest with you there.
I do. This is Barbie.
Wow.
And this is the Barbie townhouse. I don't know if we're going to be able to see it.
It's for those who are joining us audio only. We're looking at the corner of some kind of pink colossus. I would describe it as
a colossus.
It's more than just a dollhouse.
Oh, it's more than just a dollhouse.
Now, do you ever play with the Barbies? Just, you know, like I play with my kids' toys, but he's a 3-year-old boy, and he's got trucks and you know, Legos and Star Wars guys.
Yeah, I don't really play with the Barbies when Ava's not around, and I don't really watch the child entertainments. But when we're together, yeah, big time. It's a lot of fun.
It is fun. It's, you know, play acting.
Yeah.
So speaking of play acting, we're gonna interview each other today. We're gonna talk to each other. We've done 20 of these things in the can, in the bag, done. And Jeffrey, despite the fact that you have a cold, you said, you know what, let's do a special show where just you and I will get together and talk and see, you know, see what's behind, you know, lift the curtain, if you will, and see the reality that's behind this and talk to the people, meet the people. I think people want to hear more about you. And I was, so after you made that announcement, a couple of people pinged me over chat and said, are you going to, ask Jeffrey about his diet? About its workouts? Seems apropos. You all are always tweeting about those things.
I am. That's just that's for inspiration for myself. And if anyone else gets inspired, that's great. But it's really, the Quakers go into a room and they tell each other what they're doing. Community.
Sure.
Right. AA people do that. NA people do that.
Yeah.
People in, the Unitarian Church do that. They just get together and tell each other. And so, Twitter is like that for me. And I just go like, work it out again. I don't always do it. But when I remember, I just say, training.
So what are you in training for? General health? Or are you just, trying to get back health. In shape or?
I'm trying to get back in shape. I fell apart a bit a year and a half ago over some stuff that was going on. And I didn't, it wasn't serious, but I noticed that I was going to the doctor a lot and that I was having all kinds of sudden middle-aged problems, gout and other stuff. And I was like, one day I was like, this is enough. And I had been working out. I mean, I've been working out for like 20 years with no results, whatever, because I am not a good disciplinarian of myself when it comes to physical endurance of pain and so on. So, I would go out and like lift some light weight and then get bored and leave. So I'm doing weight training with a personal trainer, Hannah. Body by Hannah is her Twitter handle. And she's fantastic. And, the first day she did this thing where you basically find out how out of shape the person is, which I guess is what they do first.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was, of course, I'm sure you've done this. Have you done this?
Yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
So you just, you think you're going to die and it lasts 60 minutes.
They throw you up on the treadmill and they make you do all these other things that you've never done since you were 8 years old and
right.
Basically push you to the limit, which usually if you're doing that kind of thing doesn't take all that much.
Right. If you haven't, because our bodies weren't really meant to sit in front of a computer keyboard, right? Right,
that's
kids?
That's what they keep telling me, but I don't know if I'm willing to believe it.
We didn't have to work out in the, 12,000 years ago, we didn't have to work out because just staying alive was a workout.
You just walked around 24 hours a day and in fear of the lions, and you get a pretty good workout.
And other humans and so on, right? Yeah. But then we got agriculture, we got policemen, we got trades. And so, we got, lots of, so anyway, so you basically in an hour or 90 minutes, you're trying to get done what a normal human body would, what the animal were evolved to be would have done just in the course of a day. So that's what I do. And I do that 3 times a week with a trainer, and I try to do cardio every day. Haven't been doing anything since I got, this cold. Well, I worked out Monday with the cold. I didn't really know, and I knew I was coming down with the cold, but, it's kind of trippy. And so what do? I mean, it's really as little as possible with machines. It's just like lunges, right? Spider crawls where you bend from the hips, you put your hands on the ground, you crawl your feet out, you do a push-up, you go back.
So how, Jeffrey, how rampant do you think being in poor health is in our community of people who tend to work 15-hour days in front of a computer and then go out to eat, and when they eat pizza and they drink beer, and how much of a problem is that? You run these conferences. What do people tell you?
I don't notice it in the women as much, but in the men, I still have like more of a belly than I want, for instance, but I will notice that guys 20 years younger than me also do. I'll be like hanging out and everybody, eats real badly, drinks beer and all this stuff. And, nothing wrong with it. It's like, if you're not an alcoholic, there's nothing wrong with having a beer, I had a really interesting thought that just flipped right out of my brain,
Well, this again, everybody who's joining us now, they're witnessing the effects of your cold, perhaps affecting your.
Yeah, we'll blame it on the cold.
You do. Well, you do have a cold, and before this, we had a little conversation, and you seem better now. Whatever you did between then and now, it seems to have.
Honey.
I
would just say, work out with a trainer if you can afford it, because I don't have to think. See, I have to think all day long. I don't do much anymore. I basically make decisions. Other people who are more talented and smarter do things, and then I go yes or change this. Right.
Well, see, this is actually
my function and
a good segue.
Okay.
Because this is what I wanted to ask you about. When I first met you, and when believe it or not, people think maybe have met in person. That would seem like a likely thing because you've met everybody and everybody's met you except me. And this is in no small part because I rarely travel. And and when I do, it's hardly ever to the cool events that you and all the other people not only attend, but seem to put together and run so effectively. But we've never met in person.
You're a family man. I mean, you've got Joel, you're married, everything's good.
That's
and
true.
Also, I think you're afraid to leave the house.
I have left. And what I've seen out there is, I'm still coming to terms with what's out there. But no, I do leave. I leave. I occasionally go to Home Depot. So the thing is,
how did we actually meet? How did we meet? Do you remember?
Yeah, I absolutely remember. I was a reader and huge fan of Zeldman.com. Which is still where you blog and still frequently blog. And at the time, and we covered some of this, by the way, if you're interested in an introspective of Jeffrey Zeldman's career and a little bit about his inspiration and life, you can listen to the first episode of The Pipeline, the interview show that I do. Was honored that you were the first guest I ever had on that show. So thank you again for being there. But we met. I was reading your website, and I don't know if I submitted something I had done. It might have been the email address encoder. It might have been something else. But for some reason, you linked to Hive Logic, which was in its infancy. This would be back in like 2000, and you linked to it, and I was oh my god. Zeldman linked to me. It was like I stood up in my cube and I looked around and I said, Jeffrey Zeldman just linked to me, Zeldman.com. And people were like, Are you hogging our modem again, Dan? Because, you know, this was like, we had like a 5600 baud modem, and I was like, had it on my computer in the office, and that was it.
Who were you working for?
I was working for a company that specialized in computer-based training, what we used to call CBTs, sort of the ancient version of what we think of as screencasts today, where we were writing software and doing presentations that would teach people how to do things like use Microsoft Word to send a letter and that kind of thing. And
were you involved in the content or the development or the user experience or all of it?
We didn't call it user experience back then, but I did all of it. I would write the what we called courses. I was also using the software, which I'm trying to remember. I think it was called AuthorWare. Does that ring a bell for anybody out there? An AuthorWare to make these computer-based training applications where you'd be taking like screenshots using the print screen key on your Windows keyboard to take screenshots of Microsoft Word, and then you would sort of annotate it and script it and have things on top of it moving and doing things. Oh. It was a nightmare.
Oh, that hurts.
It was horrible. That hurts. It was my first job out of college. And, you know, I was making more money than I'd ever made before in my part-time jobs at delivering pizza, working at Burger King, and being a bagger at the grocery store. So
those are good jobs. Everybody, we were talking about this before the show, everybody should have some jobs like that. We have some friends who are young internet millionaires, and God bless them, and that's really cool.
Yeah.
But it's weird to me to know someone who's 26 who basically, right out of the gate, knew what they wanted to do. The internet already existed when they were 19.
Right.
They figured out what they were going to do, and they just succeeded. I don't take anything away from their achievements. They're fantastic. But I think if you haven't been a security guard in a condominium you haven't been fired. I mean, I got fired as a dishwasher, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, to get fired as a dishwasher, or I worked at I had a job as an advertising account executive and copywriter out of a guy's house.
Wow.
In Chevy Chase, Maryland. It was like some marketing guy. He was like basically freelancing, and he decided he didn't want to actually do his own work. He had me come in, and like his rich kids were smoking pot in the basement, and I'd knew, and you know, and then he fired me. He fired me because I wasn't professional enough. You know, I'm like, I think, should I walk your dog? She's barking a lot. You know,
well,
I think if you haven't had jobs like that or you know, sandwich maker, right? I think I sold encyclopedias door to door. I think that's, well, I failed to sell encyclopedias door to door. I think like all that kind of stuff is really good for the character. Like that kind of, like for one thing, you realize how good you have it when you find something you like to do and you can make some money.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, these kids that you know, our kids, obviously, but
kids today,
the kids today that are in many cases our peers, our coworkers, the people that we work with, you know, they grew up in a world where they don't necessarily remember not having a computer or not doing homework or having that as part of their schooling. I mean, it's such a different place to be in that. We were really there, I think, at the beginning of all of this stuff. So we have such a different perspective. But yeah, I mean, the idea of like getting my first real job, I was like, I can't believe I'm going to get paid. Part of my job, or most of it, is like, I'm going to get to use a computer as part of this job. That was so exciting to me. And there are people today, like unless you're driving a truck, and even then, of course, you're using a computer of some kind, right? And I mean, I remember when cell phones were not allowed in the office. You know, you couldn't, you know, laptops were really, they weren't sure if people could take the laptops home. You know, maybe there was two laptops for the department to use as a shared resource because they were so prohibitively expensive. I mean, the world has changed so much. So when I started reading Zeldman.com, like I felt like you were talking specifically to me, not in the sort of like crazy way, like I think he's writing just for me, but you were speaking to me as a member of a very, very, very small community. And those right. kinds of small communities now, they exist, but they exist as subsets of a much, much, much larger community today.
Which if you were to leave the house and go to like South by Southwest Interactive, for
right.
instance.
I've heard about that place.
I mean, yeah, but like it's a great conference, but like when I started going, there were, let's say, 1,000 attendees, and I probably knew half of them.
Really?
And half of them knew me. Like we all knew each other because, hey, there's the 40 other bloggers.
Right.
Oh, you're the guy that invented Rails and you're the other guy who knows how to use it. I mean, right? it's great. We're like one of the strongest engines of the global economy, which isn't saying much in this economy, but the web is exploding and now there's, 10,000 people and, I almost got run over at South by Southwest last year and a whole bunch of people standing on a curb said, look, that guy almost got run over. They didn't say, oh my God, Jeffrey Zeldman almost got run over. How ironic that would be if Zeldman got run over at South by Southwest. No, it was just like that guy almost got run over. And I was like, okay, it's different. And this is, I love that conference. I'm always going to go. It's the success of the medium, right? It's the explosion of the medium. So, here we are on the cusp of everything, right? With all these new capabilities. And yet you, who can, write code with the best of them and maybe run circles around a lot of people, you have chosen this time to pull back and say, you know what I'm going to do instead? I'm going to do a podcasting network and I'm going to support my family that way. And that's a pretty remarkable decision. How did you come to that decision?
You mean, how did I decide to do this thing here?
Yeah. To do the 5x5 network, to do podcast, instead of saying, wow, now that we have zero auth and HTML5 and X, Y, and Z, I'm going to finally build that self baking oven.
Right.
I'm going to become a rich internet millionaire like my friends. No, you said, I'm going to set up a network.
Well,
how did you come to that decision? Is that, it's an interesting time to have made that decision.
Well, I think for me, this is almost coming back to what I had originally planned and always kind of wanted to do. I wanted to, I was a radio TV major in college before I was, before I did anything else. I had the, without giving you like the long, boring story of my entire life, I had very early exposure to computers. Like when I was about 10 or 11 years old, when the Apple II was cutting edge, I was lucky enough to go to a camp at a local university where my mom taught. And for whatever reason, they would every day, 5 days a week, they'd pull us off the field, from playing kickball and sit us down in front of computers for 30, 60 minutes. And you had the choice of either learning to write programs in BASIC, which the computer would boot up into, or you could play games. And I was one of the kids that wanted to learn how to write programs to print your name on the screen and things like that, which was very exciting. I mean, that if you could do that, you were like, you were big time. So, that my exposure was very early and I always knew that I wanted to be in computers. So I knew that I would do that. And by the time I was in college, I was like a computer geek. I was helping out the writing labs and the computer labs and stuff. So I always knew I could do that, but my long time love, ever since I was a very, very little kid, was always radio and communications and that kind of thing. So my dad used to have the Morse code thing up in his little office upstairs. And, I always got into broadcasting. I listened to talk radio obsessively when I was in my early teens and throughout all through college and professionally. So I always knew that that's what I wanted to do, but I was actually talked out of that by some very successful talk show hosts and they, privately were like, listen, it'll take you a decade or more just to be so that you're not, spinning vinyl in the middle of the night and, Kansas City, and you'll get fired every year or two from your job and you'll have to move across the country. None of those things sounded like fun to me, especially when they're like, if you know about computers, do that. If you can write, do that. So I took that advice and for better or for worse, I said, this is what I'm going to be, doing. And I knew that I could do computer programming and development and I knew that I could write. And those were the two things that they felt like a sure thing. But as soon as I thought, as soon as Shoutcast came out, I had a Shoutcast show. And as soon as podcasting was something you could do, especially when iTunes started supporting it, I had that going. But I never really thought it was something that could be self-sustaining. Jeffrey, you're in a situation where you think, man, maybe if we could get a sponsor for this one show, if we could get enough listeners, maybe it'd pay for the hosting. But things really changed. And meanwhile, I was, you know, I was in a number of startups. I got to have a CTO after my name. And eventually I just said, you know, that's not the life that I feel like I really want to live right now. You know, I've done software development. I've led teams of developers and IT guys and all of that stuff. It's fun and it's great. But I always thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could do what I really, really love, which is this essentially. And, you know, I took a look around and I said, people are really accepting now of podcasts, and podcasts in many cases, audio and video, can be big business. This is where people go because of the internet, because of this kind of distribution. People can rely on independent content creators to provide them with analysis and information. And you know what? Places like NPR and your local radio stations and most of what's on TV, they're not bringing you the kind of content that you and I, for example, and our many guests on this show and the other shows are bringing. You can't turn on your local NPR station or your local news station and find out about this stuff. It's just not there. Somebody needs to cover it. Somebody needs to talk about it. And the internet makes it possible for somebody like me in a home studio, basically, to do that and to reach hundreds, literally hundreds of thousands of people. So I thought, why not do it now? You know, I'm in a situation where I was a CTO of a Rails hosting company, and you know, I knew that wasn't right for me. And you know, I said, well, when that kind of ended, I said, well, you know, I can definitely do some screencasting stuff. And Jeffrey Grossenbach, who runs Peepcode, said, oh, Dan, I'd love you to help me out with this. And I did some screencasts with him, and that was great. But I was sitting there thinking, this is an opportunity for me to really do something different. I can either go back into consulting and write software for other people, or I can try to fulfill a dream. And I looked at what people like Leo Laporte are doing with Twit, This Week in Tech, and MacBreak Weekly, and shows that I so love and enjoy. And I thought, you know, if he's able to not only pay his own bills, but he has people working, he's got a studio. If I could get a tiny little percentage of that kind of money to pay enough to pay my bills, I could do this happily for forever. And that's what I set out to make happen. So thanks to people like you, I'm doing it.
Well, you have a lot of gifts that make it a feasible choice for you. And do you remember episode 3, we interviewed Melissa Pierce?
Yeah.
Homemaker turned filmmaker.
Sure.
Right. So she over the weekend at the Dumbo Arts Festival, I finally saw her film Life in Perpetual Beta, and it's interviews with all kinds of mostly internet people, but it's all about that. It's all about like rethinking your dreams and seizing this moment and saying, what can I do? What can I do with the stuff of this moment? It's interesting what you talked about too, because I had a professor talk me out of my film career, and then I wanted to have a music career, but I failed and drank myself out of a music career. So, and I had no, you know, the web didn't even exist when I started. We were talking first about that, you know, just about, I mean, I had a girlfriend that would program animations in C++ and Lisp and Pascal, and she would spend like weeks writing code, and then this little hula dancer with a square for a head and square hips would go boom, 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 and that was it. And, you know, and it was awesome. And I used DOS and Personal Composer to run my music studio, which was a monochromatic command based. Yeah. So those were the days, you know, and
I just remember, going to Zeldman.com every morning. This is before RSS, before tabbed browsers. I mean, you know, you'd go there and you'd say, what's he going to write today? And you'd go, and then once in a while you'd drop this little gem, like you'd upload a screenshot of your desktop, and it was like a window into this dream reality of the guy who's like getting paid to make websites. Like, how cool would that be to actually get paid to make, even if you know he's
barely.
He,
Barely,
but you were doing it. You were doing it. And it was so inspirational. And I remember, you know, when you and I started actually, you know, exchanging emails and things like that, I was like, I can't believe Jeffrey Zeldman is writing to me. And, you know, now having known you, we've worked on projects together and we've done a number of these shows together. I've known you for so long. I think of you as a friend, but I still remember that feeling, and I'm reminded of it frequently because people will email me and they'll be like, "Dan, I'm so sorry to bother you. I'm a huge fan. Please stop reading. I'm ashamed to have wasted your." I'm like, "Dude, I'm just a guy. Just email me. You know, it's." But I think Twitter helps with that. I think Twitter
takes some of that fake celebrity ads off.
Yes, yes,
and makes us more aware that we are just people. I remember when David Siegel. I think I wrote to David Siegel. And he was like the first serious designer on the web. And I just wrote some gushing hero letter maybe, or I don't know what I wrote to him, but it was 1995, right?
Right.
And he wrote back. And I was like, wow, I'm going to bronze this. Can you bronze, you bronze an email? And I met Glenn Davis, who had started Cool Set of the Day, which, you know.
Oh, yeah.
At the time was amazing because he was doing it. And he had a lot of taste and a lot of personality. And I remember when I met him in Palo Alto, I thought, you know, I am living the dream. But the Twitter's nice, and Twitter and Facebook are interesting too, because they give you a false intimacy with people you don't really know. So, you know, I'm friends with Debbie Harry on Facebook.
Yeah.
Right. Does this mean that if I'm bored on Saturday, I can call Debbie Harry and say, "Want to have dinner?" No.
So tell me something. I mean, you know, how many readers do you think Zeldman has today?
Not many. I don't know.
Do you think that Twitter is a bigger part of your presence today? I mean, you've got almost 100,000 followers on Twitter, and that, you know, for the people, whenever I ask people who have that many followers, usually they're like, "Oh, well, you know, I don't know why I have that many." And I think there are people out there who have 100 followers and they're like, "How do I get 1,000 or how do I get 10,000? And the number seems to be something that people focus on. Is it that important? Do you feel different knowing that you have that big of an audience out there?
I think I used to have like a million readers a month at Zeldman.com. So that felt big. And I can tell you how to lose those readers. And like, one way is to become successful, right? Because you don't have time. Just like you made the decision to do this now.
Yeah.
John Gruber at some point made the decision, "All right, I'm just going to write my blog."
Right.
And it's a fantastic blog and he's very talented and he's found all these readers. And, you know, I don't know how much money. Well, I don't know what he makes from advertising and all that, but he made this decision and it's really working for him. I probably could have done that then, but that was the time when designing with web standards broke and people started approaching HappyCog, which was at one time just me.
It was you.
And this goes back. And having, you know, $80,000 jobs.
Yeah.
And so I would say, sure, we could, like, you know, sure, we can do that. And then I'd scramble to find freelancers to do it with me. And it was weird. I was very transparent back then. If we were getting $40,000 and I needed four people, I'd say, "We each get $10,000. It was like, I was thinking about this the other day because my mom, when I was growing up, was real. She'd go like, "Each two meatballs," right? We'd be sitting at the dinner table and my father would get two meatballs, my brother would get two meatballs, I'd get two meatballs. And I approached the initial growing of HappyCog exactly the same way, which is odd if you think about it, because that's not normally how business works. Normally you pay someone a salary and you make a profit off their work, but that didn't occur to me till, that didn't even occur to me really ever.
But, you know, one of the questions that I have for you, and this is something that has changed. I remember very vividly back in when we first started to communicate that you were running HappyCog, and it really was just you. And eventually I had an opportunity to work on a couple things with you and help out with the List Apart. Which were such wonderful, wonderful opportunities for me, for my career. So thanks again to you for that. But I remember at some point you made a decision or a change in your own career to say, I'm not going to be this guy who's sitting in my home office, my home studio, writing HTML and CSS all day. I'm going to start running this business a different way. And I'm not sure if other people were aware that you made a decision or a change. I was, because I was sort of on the edge of that circle of people who knew things that you were doing. But tell me about that. What prompted you to make that change?
Yeah. I don't want to sound like Jason Fried, but I, you know, when he says we don't plan, I don't plan. I mean, I sort of noticed what was happening and then made decisions about what seemed to be happening. But I can tell you exactly first Apple contacted me and said, can you make our website standards compliant? And they also contacted Douglas Bowman, asked him the same question. Then Doug and I met at South by Southwest Interactive, learned that we were both up for the same gig, agreed that we respected each other and didn't want to compete with each other, and went back to Apple and said, you can get both of us for the price of one. Apple did that, and then the job didn't work out for various reasons. But we said, you know, wow, well, we've done all this. We've done all this prep for this job that didn't happen. We ought to work together again. Capgemini came around, and it was a very big job, much bigger than something I could take on alone. And so I brought in, I was working with Brian Alvey on the back end, terrific guy, and Adam Greenfield on IA, which is what we called it then, because, you know, I really wanted someone very smart to go through and make recommendations about, you know, because it was a typical website that of the time that had been around for 10 years and they just added all the stuff onto it. And, you know, there wasn't. So how do you take all that content and all those years of content and figure out what's the content you want to keep and how should you actually be approaching an audience and what are people coming here to do? All that stuff. And Adam was brilliant at that stuff. Karen McGrain at Razorfish, I believe, was he had worked for, as pretty much everyone I know in user experience, either worked for Karen McGrain or worked for Lou Rosenfeld. It's kind of amazing. Anyway, so there we were, this group, and Doug Bowman and I were both designers, right? We were both designers / coders, right? Both, you know, front end web designers, and I won't say we competed, but we both did designs for Capgemini, and the client liked mine, but I didn't like mine. I liked Doug's. I looked at Doug's as a creative director, and I said, this Doug Bowman's design is much more appropriate for their brand, and it's much more extensible. It will expand with them as they change, and mine looks edgier, which I think was why the client was very – I think the client liked mine because it had a certain, like, nowness to it or whatever, but I looked at it and said, you know what? This is going to look stale in 2 years. Not even 2 years. This is going to look stale, and then they'll be stuck with it for another 10 years, and that's ridiculous. So I persuaded the client to buy Doug Bowman's design, and then in the middle of that, Doug threw his back out, and I needed someone. Doug's design needed to be finished, and I thought, I don't trust myself to design like Doug. I need someone better than me who's really talented to come in, working with the tools Doug was using, and just finish it. So I had read an essay by Jason Santa Maria on his blog, jasonsantamaria.com, and I loved what he'd written. I loved his thinking. And of course, this was when Jason's website looked like an old paperback book. Right. And I just loved that. Many people have tried over the years to make websites that look like stuff. I've certainly done it. Everyone's done it. You know, it looks like graph paper. It looks like a letter. It looks like a message in a bottle.
Right.
But Jason, with his unique eye and incredible talent, had made this really gorgeous page. So I said, I've got a job for you if you want it, but it sucks. You've got to come in and not be Jason Santa Maria. You've got to come in, completely sublimate yourself, and be Doug Bowman until Doug is better and on his feet. And we've got to do this. We'll tell the client. We're not going to try to pull the wool over the client's eyes, but you're not going to be able to come in here as a designer and make your own decisions. You're going to have to make decisions, the kind of decisions Doug would make, and be subordinate to me, even though, you know, you're a much better designer than me. And he said, sure. And he did it, and he did a great job. And afterwards, I was like, okay, client was happy. Doug got better. Thank goodness. Everyone's happy. And I thought, okay, well, you know, it was kind of a different experience. Let's look at this. We were able to take on this much bigger job. And I was able to step back from my own work and not be competitive, not be like some, I worked for some great creative directors over the years, but I also worked for some that were competitive, and that's the worst. You don't want someone giving you the wrong strategy or saying, why don't you do the one that looks like underwear and I'll do the, you know, like, no. So I really liked doing that. I mean, and it's a trade-off, you know. I still do design and I still keep, you know, I still write code and I still keep my hands in the stuff, but not as much as I did. I ended up, you know, and today I do a lot of strategic stuff. Today we have Greg Hoy and Greg Story running these amazing teams out of Philly and San Francisco. And most of what happens in the New York office now is planning for an event apart or editorial work for a list apart or editorial work for a book apart. It's, you know, and just like you got into, basically you got into radio just when it's possible to do really amazing stuff with web apps. I got into publishing, you know, I got into book publishing, not, you know, I mean, we do have EPUBs, but basically it's print. And that was the same kind of thing. It's like, wow, now is such a great time to try another dream, you know, to try that life in perpetual beta thing.
Right.
And just go for it. Like, and so,
but in a way, Jeffrey, I think what you're describing to me is it sounds like this process of you sort of elevating the Happy Cog, an event apart, a list apart, and Zeldman.com brands were kind of in the way I feel about them as an observer, is that you actually elevated them by taking a different role, and that different role was, I'm not going to do this hands-on work and I'm going to take a risk and kind of take a step back from that, find people who, and it's hard, you know, you make it sound easy, but for a lot of people, I think it's hard to say these people are better than me. And I think when you make that transition in your mind to say there are plenty of people who are a lot better than me, I want to work with those people, but here's something I can do really well. That's what you did. And I think it completely transformed your business, your day-to-day job. And I mean, I really remember that time period when you were every day, you know, literally pushing pixels around. And now you have people who, as you say, do that really well working for you. How has that changed your philosophy? Does it change your perspective?
You know, what it enables you to do, and I push pixels around every day. I put up a picture of you on my website, and, you know, I softened it in Photoshop and color corrected it in Photoshop before I slapped it up there. It's nothing, but it's just like a simple little production task, a simple minor art directional task. But so, it, you know, it keeps, you know, I have Photoshop open every day, right? I have web editing software open every day at some point in the day. But yeah, I think what it enables you to do is step back and see patterns in what people are doing, so where the business is going, where the industry is going. Running the conference with Eric Meyer has really helped me see where the industry is going. There was a time, let's say in 1998, 1999, where Steve Champion and Jeff Veen and Dory Smith and a few other people and me on the Web Standards Project really had a sense of where the web could go with web standards and what was happening. And other people didn't really have that sense. And so we were communicating that, and we were on the edge. And then, you know, as I've handed off things, and it's not really me that's elevated Happy Cog. It's all, you know, it's Chris Cashdollar. It's all the amazing people that work at Happy Cog that have elevated that brand. It's, you know, it's Marcy and Toby and Eric that have made an event apart something amazing, and our amazing speakers that have made it amazing, and the attendees, really, because we have really smart attendees. Enough ass kissing, but it's really true. But you're able to, you know, now I can, by looking at the conference, you know, at the beginning of the year, I look at, you know, what are people talking about? These seem to be patterns. And so I'm able to be visionary again. In other words, I'm able to see what other people, you know, what are the trends and what, you know, because initially I was able to see that because I wasn't getting enough work. When I was running the Web Standards Project, I wasn't getting enough work, but I had a cheap rent in New York City, which was possible to have. And, as long as I could pay for cigarettes and Chinese food, which was, those were my vices at the time, I was fine. But then, so the initial success from all the stuff that I was doing with no hope of success, not looking for success, just trying to give back to community, right? All the web standard stuff ended up bringing money and income and work. And so I was doing all that work, and then I got bogged down in how I was doing this stuff. And at first I was ahead of the game, and then I was behind the game. You know, yeah. After a while, you're like, so again, by having all these people, you know, I'll say, guys, are we really thinking, you know, I'll come in and, you know, talk to Mark Hewitt or about something, or like, are we really keeping our eye on that? And he'll go like, oh yeah, we're doing that, and we're doing this. And I'll go like, oh, carry on. So, you know, I think I had a creative director. He'd done the spicy meatball commercial. I don't know if you're young enough, old enough to remember that.
No, I remember. That's with the
Alka-Seltzer.
Yeah, the Alka-Seltzer, and you had that. That's a spicy meatball.
Marvin.
Yeah,
Marvin Honig. He said he'd done that, right? So that was his claim to fame.
Wow.
He said to me when I was in advertising, if you're not a creative director by the time you're 40, get out of the business. So that stuck in my head, and I didn't make it to be a creative director in advertising, but what I kept that in mind. And as I got older, I thought, you know, here's the opportunity, or here's what I happen to be doing anyway. You know, plus there was a high school reunion that I didn't go to because I was ashamed of where I was in life. And I lied and said I was a creative director, even though I was just, a worker bee. And so I guess I wanted to redeem that and have it come true. Kind of like Citizen Kane making his girlfriend a star.
Yeah.
That's right. With take the quotes off Singer in Love Nest.
Right.
Kane found with Singer. So I was like, yes, I am a creative director. I'll show you. But, you know, I didn't – I think if you set out to do things, it won't work. I mean, for me, what works is –
So you had no plan, you had no long-term plan, or did – it's because it seems like you do. It seems like you must have one now.
Yeah, no. I don't know. If you ask me what we're going to do next, I mean, Happy Cock has some products coming out soon and stuff, but if you really ask me what we're going to do next, I couldn't tell you. It evolves, and you notice – I think it's about pattern finding, and I think that's my job now. My job is to connect with the audience of our shows and books, and to connect with potential clients and see what their needs are. And then, you know, I mean, the most work I do in a way is on the conference and the magazine, right? Because I really have to, you know, and there, I mean, we've got some amazing people working on A List Apart, Carolyn Wood, Krista Stevens, Mandy Brown, my gosh, and our producers, and Jason Santa Maria and Kevin Cornell Illustration. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, there's it's mostly I look over people's shoulders.
Yeah.
My first professional job, my boss, we used to snort coke and walk, manage by walking around. And I was like, well, of course you're walking, man. If you sit down, you'll bite your nails off. But, so, Dan,
yes.
Golly.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about Corked. We haven't talked about
that.
There's so much stuff. We haven't talked about our spiritual practices. We haven't talked about dietary things or who we're going to have on the show next.
There's a lot. And there's questions in the audience. But one thing I want to just comment on that I liked hearing is that you said you have Photoshop open every day. And I think, you know, it's interesting that even when you make a transition to doing something else, it's almost nice to have that anchor, thing that's sort of familiar, even if it's something that you're only involved in a peripheral way now, you know, that and that's true for me. I mean, the CMS that powers 5x5, I mean, that's a Rails application that I wrote, and the design it's a design that I did that. So it's not great. It's not going to win any design awards, and I'm sure there are bugs in the app, but it's still fun to keep, you know, to get your hands dirty once in a while and do something like that. And I like that you said that, because I think that shows that connection, and it's a neat way to kind of still feel like you are creating in a fun way.
You have to, and you can't do it for people. You can't.
Right.
The worst kind of creative director is the one who opens someone else's Photoshop file and changes things in it to show them what they want, or you're like a director that acts out a part. One of my favorite directors was Alfred Hitchcock, though, and he started as an art director, and he worked his way up, and he knew how to do every job, and he could say to the lighting director, you know, do such and such, and when everything that he said was feasible because he knew how to. He didn't tell them how to do their jobs,
right? But he knew the scope of what could be done or what they could do. I think that's why people like this show, Jeffrey. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think some of these shows on a good day when there's a great show, why they often resonate with the audience is because people like you and I have spent decades doing this stuff day in, day out. It's different than somebody who shows up to just talk about it, and they come and no offense to people with broadcasting backgrounds. I mean, they excel in ways that I probably never will be able to, but somebody whose focus is technology journalism, they haven't spent hundreds of hours writing code or doing designs or whatever. And you know what, even if you started out and with, you know, HTML 4 or earlier prior to that, even if that's your forte and you haven't touched it since then, if you know, you still have a knowledge that somebody who's outside of these fields doesn't have. And I think if things resonate with people, I think that's a big part of why. Listen, before we do start to wrap this up, there are some questions in the chat room that I want to ask you. This one is from Petra Gregorova, who she's going to be a guest on an upcoming conversation, by the way. But here's her Excellent. Question. With all the success that you both have achieved so far, but I'll direct this one at you. What else do you think or would you like to do or achieve to get to the next level, if there is one? So that's a good question. What's next? What can you strive for next? You're paying bills. You're no longer using money to buy Chinese food and cigarettes, I'm guessing. So what's the next thing?
Well, I think products are a big thing. Some other form of publication, possibly an additional conference targeted more toward less toward people who build websites and perhaps more toward people who need work done. I've talked with the two Gregs about, I shouldn't talk about this because someone else will go and do it. But, you know.
Don't say
there's
it.
I won't say it. So there's that.
When it was somebody else also asked Jeffrey, can you talk about small self-publishing? I mean, you are now sitting at the edge of a brand new, I don't know what the word is, career as a publishing agency, maybe the man running or co-running a small publishing agency, a new imprint in town.
It really helps to have worked with real publishers first. I don't think you'd just want to publish. When I was 21, I wrote three novels that sucked, and I could have self-published them. And I mean, there are some really good self-published authors, to be sure, like John Sundman and Cory Doctorow. But and they have astounding talent. But for me, and in this kind of writing, it was really important, I think, to work with people like I've been fortunate to work with new writers, and they're really great. And I learned a lot about the stuff. I think you have to have good partners. You don't want to try to do it all yourself again. So Mandy Brown is our editor. Aaron Kassane did a lot of the initial strategic thinking, and Jason Santa Maria is the art director and creative director. My gosh, you know,
look at this. You basically pulled an Apple here. You pulled an iPhone here. And that is, you know, before the iPhone came out, you know, I forget if it was the guy at Motorola or the guy at Nokia or where they were from, but they said regarding Apple, they're not just you don't just launch a new phone and have success. You know, they're not just going to walk in. They're not just going to show up and do this. And look at this. You guys show up. You get this brand new imprint started. And I mean, you're cranking these things out. They're trending up. People, and I've read it. They're great. They're great books. They're just the right length. They're like it's this whole different take on publishing. To call it small publishing isn't even fair, I don't think. It's a whole different take on things. And it's so refreshing. There are these shorter books. And you know, shame on you for not doing this sooner.
Well,
Why now? Why now? You asked me earlier in the show, why now? Why now? Why do something, print up a piece of paper? When there's Kindles out now. I mean, why paper?
Well, we all love books, and you know, and I had that same argument. I argued with Jason and Aaron. I said maybe Maybe we shouldn't be following Gutenberg while our friends are making stuff like WordPress. Maybe we should be, you know, doing more, you know, making inventions that leverage our abilities on the internet instead of, but, you know, we love books. And it really helped that Jeremy Keith wrote our first book. He's an amazing talent.
He's a smart young man.
And, you know, John Alsop was trying to convene a meeting about HTML5, and then John wasn't able to participate, so I convened it, and we got all these people together. And the smartest guy in the room, I mean, not overall, perhaps, but as far as HTML5 was concerned, was Jeremy Keith. And I thought, boy, you know, this would be such a great topic. With what I'm hearing from Jeremy, I wish I could share that with everyone who makes websites. He so has such great insights into HTML5. So when it came time to write our first book, I knew it had to be HTML5. I knew Jeremy had to write it. He said yes. I actually said, Jeremy, I'd be glad to co-write this book with you. And he said, that's great. You don't have to co-write it. So he wrote it, and that was great. And, you know, and then it helped that a week before we published it, a week before it hit, it came out in our store, Steve Jobs, you know, said, we're not supporting Flash anymore.
Right.
It's a crock. We're just going to use, he doesn't talk, that's my Steve Jobs impersonation. He said, we're just going to use HTML5. And by HTML5, he meant CSS3 and HTML5. Right. And God knows what he meant. But all of a sudden, like, you know, Steve Jobs moved his lips and said HTML5. And suddenly we said, and here's the book. I mean, the timing couldn't have been better. So, you know, that had to account for some of the success. And then just the incredibly charming, disarming way that Jeremy writes and speaks. Huge, you know, huge.
You know what, Jeffrey? I think we may have overstayed our welcome. I think we may need to do another one of these things, but...
Not for a long time.
Yeah, we'll have to do another 20 episodes. But I want to say thanks to you for doing this with me today. Thanks to our sponsors, both the GetSceneOn.tv and MailChimp.com for sponsoring us. And thanks to everybody for tuning in. And we'll see you all again next week. Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thank you. Bye-bye.